Jay Bahadur's first interview in Somalia ended early when one of that country's most important pirates needed his fix of khat, the leafy stimulant that's the drug of choice for pirates. Before that, though, Boya described his transition from fisherman to pirate after the reefs where he used to hunt lobster were destroyed by foreign trawlers. But while that may be true, it's far from the whole story. Jay Bahadur spent 3 months in Puntland, a semi-autonomous region in Somalia, and learned that much of what we think we know about these modern buccaneers is wrong. Jay Bahadur joins us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. His new book is The Pirates of Somalia Inside Their Hidden World, and it's nice to have you on the program with us today.
Thank you very much, Neil. Pleasure to be here.
And since you first spoke with Boya, he's gained a bit of notoriety.
Well, he's in jail now, but he was the self-appointed pirate spokesman, and I think it wasn't just me, but a number of media figures swarmed to get interviews with him because he was always great for a good quote, and he was always very willing to talk to media. And when the U.S. government decided they needed to clamp down on Somali piracy, he was the first one to be made an example of. So he's now serving a life sentence in Puntland's only one and only prison.
And it's if you make yourself the self-appointed chairman of the pirate committee of elders, you're going to get some renown.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that he claims to have been responsible for the hijacking of 25 to 60 ships, which I think is an absolutely ridiculous number. Like with many of information coming out of the mouths of pirates, it's a bit exaggerated. And so the thing is now this number, if you can find very easily on Google, this claim that he's hijacked up to 60 ships, which, it's funny because this is basically put him in jail when it's not even the truth. So, his mouth has definitely got him into trouble, that's for sure.
Well, he clearly, though, did hijack some ships.
Oh, most definitely. It's just that, early in 2008, I think there was something like a total number of the ships hijacked was 68, I think, something along those lines. So he was basically claiming, most of that total. So it stretches credulity, put it that way. There's no doubt that he's been involved in the trade since the 90s, and he began with attacking fishing ships. But I'm just saying that the 60 number was so far out of left field that he was essentially assuming more guilt than he could have possibly committed.
And the attacks on foreign fishing vessels, that goes back to the story that we always hear about these pirates. They don't call themselves that. They call themselves defenders of Somalia.
Right. The actual term they used was Badadita Bada, which roughly translates to saviors of the sea, which was the title of the first article I wrote because it was all about, how they refer to themselves in this way. And it's been often translated, I think, in the English-speaking media as Coast Guard. So that's definitely their PR angle, no doubt about that.
And there's an element of truth to that, but there's an element of, exaggeration about that, too.
Yeah, I think early on it's a justification that's really turned into a rationalization now. Early on, especially Boya and his men were legitimately aggrieved by foreign fishing. There's third-party evidence, including by very credible sources such as the UNDP, that foreign fishing ships came in through drag fishing, destroyed lobster habitats. In many cases, they were armed, especially in the later years, towards the end of the 90s. They were armed with anti-aircraft guns and often brought essentially contracted security from local warlords and so on, shot the local people, in many cases ran over their gear. One story that was told to me by the inhabitants of Ale, which is Boya's hometown on the Puntland coast, was that two young lobster divers were actually caught up in a net, swept up and drowned some years back. So they definitely had a grievance. What's happened now is that it's gone so far beyond fishing. I think something like 6% of ships attacked are involved in fishing in any way. And what you hear now out of the mouth of any pirate you talk to, the first thing they say is, we're doing this because of illegal fishing. But now, for the most part, the people saying it are sort of inland thugs and militiamen, not fishermen. But it's there's very much a pirate PR machine at work. And, the evidence is that almost, like I said, almost the exact same line out of each one of their mouths is the same.
Why would a young man in Puntland decide to get into this business?
Well, I compare it briefly in the book. I don't like to get into the comparisons with the kind of inner city drug trade too much, but I do compare it briefly in the book to the Freakonomics study, or the study that was popularized in Freakonomics about inner city crack dealing in Chicago. And essentially the argument was that the crack foot soldiers, the one dealing on the streets and taking the biggest risk, really made very little money. But what they were doing is they were investing in a shot, a very slim shot of getting in the bigger game down the road. And it was a very quick way, I guess, if they got into this game to the higher levels, quick way to earn, respect that they wouldn't be able to or don't feel that they'd be able to achieve anywhere else. And with piracy, it's even, I think that dynamic is definitely in play. And the fact is that there's a huge tension between the diaspora, the Somali diaspora expats who are in and out of the country, speak English and Arabic, are educated, and escape the civil war, and Somalis who are stuck there to face the brunt of the violence and grew up there. And for these locals who grow up and only speak Somali, there's really only a couple sources of employment, which is providing security, like basically hiring yourself out as security, day labor, or maybe transportation, like driving, that kind of thing. And obviously for youth with, who know how to use a gun and with little other opportunities, piracy is a great way to make some money and get a car, really. It's the first thing they buy is an SUV.
You talked to a young man whose name is Umba Ali. I'm probably mispronouncing it, but he worked as what he called a holder, and I hadn't been aware of the distinction, the job categories of pirate. And holders are those who watch over the hostages after the ship's been taken and wanted to work his way up to attacker.
Yes, exactly. So this is, again, to the parallels to working your way up the crack trade. He was brought on board. He was essentially one of a gang of about 50, and his job, and most of this 50 would have been comprised of holders like him, who once the ship was captured was brought on board to guard the crew, to sit there, essentially sit on the ship and chew khat all day. Khat is the narcotic drug, very similar to coca leaf that the pirates are completely addicted to. So his job was to sit there, watch the crew, and essentially spend weeks and weeks on the ship. And so he claimed to have made 50,000 in two operations. I estimate it was probably closer to 20,000, again, with the pirate tendency to exaggerate. Mm-hmm. But then he invested all that money in an operation that didn't work out. So he was back to he was a former truck driver. And after his piracy days ended without much success, he enrolled in the security forces. So this is exactly what I'm talking about, how these, for the really lower down guys, first of all, they don't make all that much money, really. Even in Somalia, it's not that much money. And there's really only a few kind of career opportunities that they keep cycling through.
One of the myths that you address in the book or describe in the book is that the Gulf of Aden is teeming with pirates. Any ship that sails through these waters, you should really know better.
I think with 24-hour news coverage these days, one of the effects of that is to make the world seem a lot more dangerous than it is, and that's certainly something an effect that's played itself out in the world of Somali piracy. Because I think we hear about the big hijackings, the oil tankers, mm-hmm. The tank carrying ships, and so on. That really, I guess, make it seem a lot more exciting and fast-paced and glamorous than this trade really is. So in 2008, I calculated, when I wrote that, I do a chapter of myths of piracy, and that's one of them. For 2008, I calculated that something like 0.2% of, actually under 0.2% of ships going through the Gulf of Aden were actually hijacked. So it's not as big a problem as I think the media betrays it to be.
And that the navies of the much of the world are concentrated. A lot of their surface vessels are there in an attempt to, bring it at least to some degree under control, but that does not seem to be working.
No, and I think that's more of an exercise in defense theater than it is a real attempt to arrive at a long-term solution. There are currently three international naval task force operating off the coast of Somalia. The U.S. force is called Combined Task Force 151, and it's built around the U.S. Fifth Fleet, which operates out of Djibouti. And I think there's varying numbers of warships in and out of the area, but it ranges between 25 and 40 at a cost of about, I estimate, $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year. And essentially, they're tasked with patrolling an area. Pirate attacks now occur across an area about 80% the size of the United States. And if you think of 25, I mean, people use the corollary 25 to 40 police cars patrolling this area. It's not the same thing, obviously, because there's a lot more land-based crime than there is sea-based crime. But it gives you an idea of exactly how difficult a problem it is, because a warship realistically needs to be within 50, 60 kilometers, miles of an attack if it has any chance of interceding. And that's even provided that it has the capability or the interest in interceding. I mean, a lot of the warships operating in that area are working to protect their own nationals and really wouldn't care that much about foreign nationals being hijacked.
And we keep hearing that the solution to this is on land. It's not a problem that's going to be solved at sea. It has to be solved with better politics, better governance, and a much better economy in Somalia.
Yeah, I think that's a go-to line of anyone writing an op-ed on piracy in Somalia, it has to be solved on land. And I find that that line is sort of trite in the sense that, I mean, what does that mean, solving it on land? And a lot of people talk about we need to reestablish a government in Somalia as if, you know, people haven't been trying to do that for the past two decades. And they talk about this as a realistic solution to piracy, actually reestablishing a Somali government. In the book, I do think there does need to be a solution on land, but I think I go into detail into a detailed solution in the last chapter of the book. Essentially, I think it's a bit too detailed to get into here because it's a very complex problem. But essentially, what I talk about is changing the way the international community deals with Somalia, i.e., right now, the international community solely deals with the nominally, you know, official federal government in the south that controls a few blocks in Mogadishu and is desperately trying not to be chased into the sea by, you know, Islamist forces. And I think what a solution to piracy entails is changing countries' diplomatic stance towards Somalia into recognizing these small states like Puntland that have popped up all over the place. People don't like living in anarchy, and Somalia is not a country in anarchy. It's actually a country made up of, you know, some relatively stable mini-states with let's say, semi-functioning governments. And dealing directly with these governments, I think, is an important step on the way to stopping piracy.
Jay Bahadur, thank you very much for your time today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You can read more about Jay Bahadur's 45-hour slog to Puntland aboard increasingly dubious aircraft in an excerpt at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation, and Jay Bahadur joined us from the CBC studios in Toronto. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.